Well, the 306 Baum Group Historical Association is having their annual reunion. I'm president of the association, and we're having a fabulous time. We've been to the Champaign Aviation Museum in Urbana, where they're restoring the Champaign Lady, which was fascinating to see. And then today we went to the National Museum of the United States Air Force, which was unbelievable. They have these four huge hangars that have so many things to see. The highlight was seeing the restoration of the Memphis Belle. It's the most iconic warbird that fought in World War II. And they started restoring it in 2005, and they hope to have it completed by 2018, but we'll see about that. But it was just fabulous. It was the first bomber that completed 25 missions that returned to the United States. It wasn't the first bomber that actually flew 25 missions, but the first one to return to the United States. And it was an iconic warbird, as I mentioned, but then it was basically discarded, and it went from place to place to place. It was left outdoors. It had all sorts of weather damage and rust, and now they're trying to restore it, and it's a huge project. These guys that are doing this are just so dedicated, and they're making a lot of the parts themselves that need to be made, and it was fascinating to see. Are you having to manufacture a lot of parts?
Oh, yeah. What we do is we restore the original, and if we can't do that, then we find a part from another airplane, and if we can't do that, then we make it. That's the order we go in. And there's a plaque right up here on top. And you see it was manufactured in May of 1942.
Oh.
Okay, we got the serial number, so we know we got the right airplane. And, of course, it's famous for 25 missions. And that was a big deal, because in World War II, if you flew 25 missions, at least in the early part, you got to rotate back home. But they were losing an average of 10% per mission. So their odds of making 25 missions was like zilch. And when they beat the odds, it was a huge deal. They brought the crew and the plane back to the United States. They flew them around to all the major cities that were called the Bond Tour. It was to raise money for the war. It was also for the morale of the country. Following the Bond Tour, it became a training airplane down in Florida. And at the end of the war, it was scheduled to be scrapped. Okay, it was out at Aldous, Oklahoma. And, of course, a movie had been made about it called Memphis Belle in 1943. And a reporter went out and did a story on it. And the people in Memphis read that and asked if they could have the airplane. And so the Air Force sold it to them for the princely sum of $350, including delivery. And then it just sat outside by a National Guard armory for a long time. Eventually got moved by some restaurant at the Memphis airport. And finally just became so badly damaged from the weather and vandals that they tried to restore it in 1986. And then it went out to Mud Island, which is an island in the Mississippi River. We're pretty sure of that because we found silt in the horizontal stabilizers where evidently it flooded at one time. So they were trying to restore it again. They just basically ran out of money and didn't really have a place to go with it. And so the Air Force stepped in. They'd assumed ownership again in 77, and they said, it's a national treasure. We've got to preserve it. So we brought it here. So we've had it since 2005. Still got a long way to go. And this is some of the wiring. They originally used a cloth wire in here. We found a manufacturer that would make this for us.
Oh, my goodness.
It's expensive. You see all the little ties on here. They all have to be made according to Air Force specs. And we're trying to do all that just the way it was. Here is a picture of the original crew. There was 10 of them. They've all passed away now. And this is what the Memphis Belle looked like when it was flying missions. You see it's a camouflage pattern. Notice that the vertical tail right here is not camouflaged. The reason is, one of the later missions, it got damaged and they replaced it. And either because they didn't have materials or time, they did not camouflage the vertical stabilizer. Well, guess what? At least the plan right now is we're not going to do it either, because that's the way the 25th mission was.
Right.
Everybody will tell us we forgot to do it. One of the things that drives us crazy is we're trying to figure out what it was on the 25th mission, and we go through all these documents we have, and it'll say from tail number such and such to tail number such and such, it was done one way, and then they'd switch it to something else. I mean, it just continuously made changes. So trying to get it accurate is really difficult. Anyway, this is the one to the Memphis Belle. According to the serial number, this is the one they flew with. You want everybody to take a look in there, picture yourself in there for about 6 hours. And if you're having trouble with that, that's what you look like when you're in there. The baby is the only one that would fit in there comfortably. Okay. I'm told the pilot would line up his gunners, and whoever was the shortest person got this job, whether they wanted it or not. It was considered a death trap because if you had to get out, it had to be rotated into this position. You couldn't wear a parachute in here, so you'd have to climb out, get your parachute on, go look for a way out. No, they were not effective. Right here, it says, during landing or takeoff, guns must be in horizontal position. There shall be no crew member in the turret. Okay. Because of the danger if the landing gear would collapse, of course.
Well, that's, I've heard, my father didn't really know this for a fact, but he heard stories that there was a guy killed during landing.
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
Andy Rooney tells that story, and it may have happened,
right.
But we have no documented cases of it ever happening.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, if something happened, they found a way to get him out.
Yeah.
If he lost power, there's a little handle in here that he could turn to crank it and get it in this position. Of course, it takes 45 hard turns of that handle. If the radio operator was his buddy, he could come down here and grab this one. And I guess these guys bought a lot of beers for the radio operator. I would. How you control it is with these handles. Okay, it goes up and down when you do that with you in it. The guns are actually fixed and you're actually aiming the ball. When you do this, it rotates. It can rotate 40 degrees a second because they had to track an enemy airplane. Now, how it worked, I know this one pretty well. I spent a lot of time with this. Okay, that's a 24-volt motor in there with an output shaft on each side. And that actually powers motors and hydraulic pumps on either side. One side is for azimuth or back and forth, and one's for elevation. Okay? And we got excited because after all these years when we took it apart, the motor still works.
Wow.
And we said, we can fix the hydraulics. We're going to make it operate. Then our bosses found out it pulls 90 amps of current at idle. They said, no, not in 70-year-old wiring because of the danger of fire. But it would work. We did make it so that we can operate it manually. Everybody keep your fingers clear and see where it actually operates. I can turn it the other way, this way too. About 1,000 parts in one of these. And it took us almost 2 years to restore this. Three of us working on it all the time. You guys all see the movie 12 O'Clock High?
Yeah.
Okay, you remember, I forget who the star was. Was it Clark Gable or somebody?
Yeah, Clark Gable.
Okay, and one of the final scenes, he's trying to pull himself up into that.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done that when I was 25 years old. I asked crew members, did you actually do that? And they said, not if there was a ladder. Anyway, this is not the original nose art. It's from the 1986 restoration, but we left it there because it's pretty close. 25 missions represented on the 25 bombs you see on there. If there's a yellow star above the bomb, it means they were an element lead, which we think was about 6 to 9 airplanes. And if there's a red star, they were the lead of the entire bomb wing, which was about 50 airplanes. Okay, and at that time, of course, they weren't always had fighter escort because it was too far for them. And that made them a real target. So the Germans would always attack that lead airplane. And you can see all the swastikas underneath there. That's the number of German fighters they're credited with shooting down.
First of all, I can't believe a national treasure like that would have been treated so poorly and just parts thrown all over the world, right? And trying to pull all that back together. But remember when he talked about the instrument panel someone had as a coffee table in his home? Did you hear that part?
Yes, and these planes, I don't know, I guess that they thought that the war was over and people didn't need to remember, but the B-24, there's only one B-24 that's still flying. I mean, those bombers were discarded even more than the B-17. At least there's about a dozen B-17s that are flying today, thank goodness.
We're trying to do it like it was on the 25th mission. So we made that from the Boeing blueprints. Well, then we found the original panel at the 8th Air Force Museum down in Georgia.
Oh, my goodness.
When you're talking about a midnight raid. No, I didn't say that. We negotiated with them, got them to go ahead and donate it. About a year ago, they came here and made a big presentation. Turned out that they had put it on loan to a VIP who made it part of a coffee table. Okay. What he didn't know was it was radioactive. Okay, what they do is they paint these needles and numbers with radium paint so they'll glow in the dark. And depending on how they did it, it can exceed the radiation limits you're supposed to be exposed to. So we have that panel, we're going to put it in, but once we do that, then we're going to be limited in our exposure to it. Be very careful.
Watch yourself through this.
Okay.
What do you think about all the renovation work going on here?
Well, I'm amazed at all of the parts that have to be handmade.
Yeah.
And just mallets.
Yeah.
Bending. It's just,
isn't that something? Yeah. How do I tell you can't find them? They don't exist.
No.
Anymore.
Yeah. I know the 909 that comes to California, where they call me to come up in uniform.
Yes.
All of the parts in the bomb bay, you know, the mechanism where we used to crank the bomb bay doors
yeah.
open, that all had to be handmade. They couldn't find any parts.
Well, let me talk about the veterans for a second. At the end of World War II, there were 16 million World War II veterans. And today, 95% of those veterans are no longer with us. The last statistics I saw that they were passing one every 3 minutes, about 430 a year. And pretty soon, they'll be gone. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the United States and the world forever. So it's our duty to remember the sacrifice that those guys made. And the 306 Bomb Group is trying to maintain that memory and honor those veterans. We still have veterans with us. We're going to continue to have reunions until those veterans are gone. And we hope to have reunions after that with second generation, third generation, hopefully fourth generations that will keep the memory alive. So we'll keep the association going as long as we can. A lot of the bomb groups have kind of dissolved, and now the participants that are left, or the members that are left, they go to the reunions of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. So we'll see. Yeah, my dad was a pilot in the 306 Bomb Group, 369th Bomb Squadron, the Fightin' Bightin'. And I wasn't really involved in the 306 until after he died in 2007. I retired in 2009, so I was busy up until that time. And in 2010, I got an email, I think it was, from the 306 Bomb Group saying we're having a reunion in San Diego in 2011. And I thought, well, I'm retired. It's close to me. I have no excuses. I need to go. And so I went to the reunion in 2011, fell in love with the association, was asked to be a board member, became vice president, and now I'm president, and I've just enjoyed it tremendously.
Great. Can you show a copy of the book here?
Yeah, this is a book I wrote. It's called Shot Down. It's about my dad and his crew. As I said, I retired in 2009, and at that time I had the opportunity and the time to really delve into my dad's war history in further detail. But at that time, it was never my intention to write a book. I just wanted to learn more about my dad. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years. My mother had kept all the letters that my dad had written to her during the war when he was stationed in England at Thurlow. And reading those letters was absolutely fascinating. and became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I spent countless hours doing research on the internet. I started joining World War II organizations such as the 306 Bomb Group, going to reunions and listening to veterans tell their story. And finally, after 3 years, in 2012, actually at the reunion in Savannah, Georgia, I came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it had to be told. So I decided to write a book, and it was published in 2014, August. And since that time, it's won 20 book awards, and it's really changed my life. It's become a full-time passion of mine. I do a lot of speaking to also for different groups and different organizations, trying to keep the memory alive. I go to lots of air shows promoting my book, of course, but the main purpose is to honor those veterans and those guys that sacrificed so much for our freedom.
You need to come out to Colorado, to our Colorado 8th Air Force chapter.
Yes, I do.
And give us a presentation about your book and your dad, who would love to have you come out.
I'd love to do that. I was in Fort Collins in August, I think it was, and I was there. The Collins Foundation and the Wings of Freedom Tour came in with the B-17-909, and I signed copies of my books the 2 days that they were there and gave a couple presentations to the Rotary Clubs in Fort Collins, so I'd love to do that.
We should talk to Tom Mandala and Clayton Nattier, and we'll have you come out.
That'd be wonderful. I'd love to do it. Now that my middle son lives in Fort Collins, and they just had our first grandchild, so we spend a lot of time. We're going to try to spend a lot of time there.
Excellent. All right. And one more thing. So in terms of young people that don't get much history in school about World War II specifically, do you have any thoughts about that and why that's happening?
Well, that we could get into a long discussion about why that is happening. I have to say, though, that the two groups of people that I am most honored and love to read my book are World War II veterans who went through it. I'm so honored if they read my book, because those are the guys that actually fought the war. So that's a great honor. But the other group of people that I love to read my book are young people. You know. And I'm so pleased whenever I'm at a book signing that young people, whether they're, you know, maybe 8 to 15 years old, want to read my book and learn about World War II history and what happened. It's a shame that history's being lost, and that's really one of the purposes of the 306 Bomb Group and other organizations like us, is to keep that memory alive and to educate the general population, but younger generations, about the importance of this. My motto is, it's our duty to remember. We can't forget their sacrifice.
Yeah.